Good afternoon. It's nice to see you again. Today marks the halfway mark of this little series of introductory lectures in philosophy. And I thought it would be helpful at the beginning to contrast what I'm doing here with what you might be seeing in some other courses. I thought about this contrast this morning. I've been spending my mornings attending lectures by an eminent historian on the events leading up to the establishment of Israel, and he speaks at great speed for about an hour. He's utterly fascinating. He imparts a vast body of knowledge, and then he stops and there's a few minutes of questions. Which always makes me feel a little ashamed, because I think, why can't I do that? You know, I speak for a couple of minutes, I pause for questions, we chat, and then I move on. I think the reason I'm doing this is to impart something of philosophy to you, because there is a really long tradition in philosophy of to and fro, of back and forth, of debate. And the tradition goes back at least to the great ancient philosopher Socrates. If you've ever read any of Plato's dialogues, Plato was a pupil of Socrates, you'll see Socrates in action. The dialogues are frequently conversations between Socrates and other people. Socrates states his view, other people challenge it. After a while, people begin to say, that is so, Socrates, you're right, justly said. I mean, that's not my experience in philosophy debates, but philosophers never say anything like that to other philosophers. This back and forth is a really important part of what we do, and it enables us, I think, to explore and illuminate the topic more easily than if there's just a one-way flow of information. I absolutely recommend, if you're interested in philosophy, that you read an introductory book or two, and I'm happy to give recommendations, but for these lectures, the back and forth is going to be helpful. It's not padding, it's part of the philosophy talk. We talked about Anselm's argument on Monday and yesterday, we also began with the mind-body problem, this question of how the mind is related to the body. Is it a physical thing, or is it something quite different? Is it non-physical? Is it immaterial? And I offered an argument for Cartesian dualism, which says boldly that the mind or soul is this immaterial substance somehow connected to our physical bodies. What are the stakes here? I think they are really high. As I said yesterday, the question is not just what kind of being are we, an important enough question. The question is also, is there space for life before bodily birth, life after bodily death? Dualism allows for that space. Now, of course, you can be a dualist and not think that there is life after death. You might think, for instance, that we have a kind of immaterial part which is attached to our body in such a way that when our body goes, the immaterial part is extinguished as well. So it's not mandatory if you're a dualist to think there's life after death. But it does seem to be at least possible to think that there is, and it's an interesting option for you to explore. If you find this an intriguing idea, ask yourself, is dualism plausible? Can I build further views about life after death on top of it? I tried to make that argument for dualism as plausible as possible. You remember it began with Leibniz's law. We created a mental state, and then we found a distinction between the mental state and any brain state we choose, with a very exciting conclusion for the Cartesian dualist that mental states just can't be states of the brain. They can't be physical states. There must be something else. All that's left, it seems, is to be a state of a non-physical thing. But this is a difficult debate. Personally, I think that argument for dualism is profound. I think there's something really important about it. Maybe it's right. But let me offer you, as plausibly as I can, some considerations in favor of physicalism. The physicalist says, remember, that the mind or soul is physical. One's inclined to say just physical, as if you're denigrating it. I don't think that's quite right. I mean, physical, our physical cells are tremendously complex, and so much has not yet been explored. But they are physical, according to the physicalist. Let me offer an argument now in favor of this view. The argument begins with what presumably just about all of us are going to agree on, which is that our mind and our body continually interact. Our mental states cause physical states in us. Our physical states cause mental states as well. Now, We're not assuming here dualism or physicalism. This is just a common sense intuition. So here are some examples. Suppose we have Albert here. Albert happens to have met Beth at a party and he likes her. But Albert is shy. And it takes Albert quite a long time to build up that feeling of resolve he needs to get to the phone and give her a call and ask her for coffee. I had to find just the right expression. That's the feeling of resolve expression as Albert calls up Beth. Our intuition here is that his feeling of resolve that he worked hard to attain has propelled him towards the phone, to picking it up, to speaking to Beth. It's a mental state which has caused all kinds of physical states. I think that's intuitive. And the opposite kind of direction of causation can happen too. Physical states can cause mental states. Beth receives the call. There are various physical stimuli. So she picks up the phone, and there's a kind of oral stimulus. There are physical events in her ear. There are physical events in her brain. And as a consequence, she's delighted. Turns out, lucky for Albert, that she likes him too. So, I mean, I feel like the story could go on. I'm quite sad to have to carry on with this philosophy nonsense, but I want to know what happens over coffee. Anyway, here the mental state results from the physical state. And again, it's hard to deny that there is this constant physical-mental interaction. And presumably the dualist, just like the physicalist, is going to accept it. But then the physicalist has a challenge for the dualist. The challenge is this. If you think about interaction among physical things, interaction like that can be grasped. Sometimes it's quite easy to grasp, sometimes it's really challenging, but in principle it looks like it's possible. I've given you this really simple case of a series of cogs interacting. It's really easy to understand how a change in one can cause a change in the other. Of course, there are many more complicated examples, but it feels like if we work hard enough, we might be able to uncover how physical things interact, no matter what they are. But the question for the dualist is this. If you think that the mind isn't physical at all, then how are you going to explain its interaction with the physical body, in particular with the physical brain? Here's a picture of the movie of Casper the Friendly Ghost. I have a soft spot for Casper. You may remember the Casper comics. They're quite poignant. They have a kind of sweet melancholy about them, this kind of young ghostly figure haunting the comic and making friends with children. Now, but the thing that always bothered me about Casper is that it was unclear to me how Casper could interact with anybody. If Casper is really a ghost, and presumably not just made of some kind of hazy, gauzy material, but not a physical thing at all, then how does Casper get, for example, to hold up the jug of orange juice? How does Casper get to speak to the little girl? How does Casper get to be visible at all? Surely Casper's not even in physical space. Now, if I'm worried about Casper, then I think we also ought to be worried about immaterial minds. How do they interact with brains? It's not like two cogs interacting. The immaterial mind isn't physical. It isn't in physical space at all. And yet, presumably, we want to accept that this causal interaction is going on all the time. Now, you might reply, well, all we need to do is try to understand the non-physical nature of the mind better. If we really grasp it, we'll see how it interacts with the physical body. But that's going to be hard to do. Because what do we mean by a non-physical thing, an immaterial thing? It's really difficult to say anything except negative remarks about it. It's not physical. It's not material. It's not in physical space. It's difficult to get a grip on the nature of this alleged thing if all we can do is say negative things when we talk about it. So this immaterial mind that the dualist postulates seems to be essentially really mysterious. We don't know much about it, we just know what it's not. And we're certainly very unclear about how it could interact with the body at all. This is one argument, I'll offer another. This is one argument that the physicalist has against the dualist. Again, it's simply, what are you talking about? I don't understand what the substance is or how it interacts with the body. Does anybody want to offer a dualist defense? Does anybody think that actually immaterial things are less mysterious than I've painted them? Yes?
Quantum tells us that the body, the physical body, consists of more than 99% nothing but space.
Okay.
And less than 1% is actually wave, that we're only aware of by virtue of the traces they leave when we're not looking at them.
Okay, well...
The soul has created this imaginary construct that we call body.
Okay, look, I'm going to ignore the last sentence because it feels very adventurous, more than I can cope with now, that the soul actually creates this body. But suppose you're right that the physical body is largely empty space. Okay. At first one might think, well, that helps us imagine how the interaction with a non-physical soul can take place, but actually thinking about it, I'm not sure how it does. Because if the non-physical soul isn't in space at all, then it's not as though it can cozy itself up into the gaps in the body, the parts that aren't atoms. It just can't even hang out inside or near the body. It's not in physical space. I think we need to know more about the soul, and I have no idea how we could get to do so. Look, I mean, I would like to know more about Kuruman, for example. But the point is that I know how to find out more. I can look things up. I can visit it. I have no idea how to find out more about immaterial substances. Anybody else want to say something in favor? Yes. Just a sec. Yes.
How about serotonin? Is it not the connection between the physical body and the non-physical? Serotonin, which is produced in the brain and creates a certain state of mind.
I think serotonin is a nice example of the kind of physical substance that intuitively we think has mental consequences. Okay. There are all kinds of things that we do in the physical world that clearly have mental consequences, that make us feel happier or sadder, for example, that make us feel tired or hungry or all the rest. Yet I don't think that's going to deal with our problem. Because our problem wasn't that we can't describe examples of cases where the mental and physical interact. We can describe plenty. The problem was, if the mind is immaterial, we have no idea how the interaction takes place. It's all very well to say that increased serotonin causes a mental change. But if the mind is immaterial, the question is, how on earth could this change in the physical cause a change in an immaterial substance? We just don't know. There's this physical thing, sure, but then what? We can't point to anything. That's the nature of the immaterial. It's not around here. Sorry, somebody else. We'll have a last question for the moment. Somebody else had their hand. Yeah.
I would like to suggest that the soul may be a form of material, physical thing, in the sense that we know we have trillions of particles passing through our brain every second.
Yes.
And some of them may be charged. There's lots of energy out there in space. And this would affect our understanding and thinking. Therefore, the mind, as opposed to the brain, thinks from a different source. And that source may continue when the body decays after life, because these particles continue to leave us and form a sense of identity in space.
Okay, now tell me if I have this right. It's an alternative way of speaking about life after death, a physicalist kind of way. It's saying, look, even once the body has decayed, there is still some part, some portions of the body which won't decay, in which could be identical to the soul. Is this right?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I think it's a bold move because... the structure of the body decays after bodily death. So, and usually we think that the structure is somehow intimately involved with mental functioning. But I presume it's still possible. I mean, our atoms go on, and if you were to have some kind of adventurous view according to which our atoms were somehow identified with the soul, there would be no objection, no immediate objection to that. I mean, I can think of, I don't know why I should believe it, but on the other hand, I can't immediately think of an argument against it, a strong argument against it. Let me mention now a second physicalist concern. and it's this. Think about the chain of causation. Well, the physical chain of causation, given any event, seems to be complete. Let's think about the chain of causation between being stung by a bee and your arm jerking away. You're stung by a bee, there's some kind of message to the brain, there's some kind of brain event, there's a message back to the arm, and your arm jerks away. All of that is physical. That's not to say it's simple, of course. It's going to be tremendously complex. But it's physical. And some people think that there's good evidence to say that given any event and any other event which it results from, where these are physical events, there's always a physical chain of events between them. That chain is complete. Well, if that's the case, then if you want to be a dualist and say the mind is not physical, then it seems you have to admit that the mind doesn't have any influence over what we do. If the chain of events in the world, the physical chain of events, is complete and there are no gaps, then what work is there for a non-physical and immaterial mind to do? It seems that the mind, so to speak, doesn't get any action. It's just one physical event resulting from another. But that would be crazy. I mean, surely the dualist would have to admit that that's not true. Our mental events have all kinds of effects. It's because Albert feels the strong sense of resolve that he goes to the phone and he picks up and he calls Beth. So it looks like the mind, in order to have any influence on us, just has to be a physical thing. If it weren't physical, it wouldn't have influence. The only things which have influence already are physical. That's a fairly complex argument. Does anyone have thoughts? Yes.
Surely the mind could overturn that. You could see the bee, you would have the chain reaction, but your mind would say, I won't move my arm.
If we found a process which worked like this, a physical event results in another, and then there's a gap, and then somehow a physical event spontaneously takes place after that, then it would be fair to say, aha, an immaterial event has been influential here. There's a gap in the physical chain, that's where the immaterial mind is involved. But if the physical chain is complete, then if you want to say the mind is involved, it looks like you're going to have to say the mind is material. If it weren't material, it wouldn't get any of the action. It wouldn't have any influence on things. I mean, everybody's going to agree with you if you say, look, when you're stung by a bee, you can decide not to jerk your arm away. You can decide to be like those various legends of ancient, you know, Macedonian boys, you know, who stoically stand there while they're stung by bees. Sure, you can decide that. But the physicalist says, there's even a complete physical chain of events between being stung by the bee and keeping your hand right there. Which means that that mental process must be a physical one. If it weren't, it wouldn't have any influence on us. It's only physical events which influence what we do. That's the argument. You know, the truth is I feel a little sad when I see arguments like that, because I find dualism very exciting. I find it thrilling and evocative and pleasing in many ways. But one has to respond, if you want to be a dualist, to arguments like this. I guess there's another approach, but it's a really brave one. This is a word you can drop into conversation and people will be impressed. You can say, look, I'm taking an an epiphenomenalist approach to mental causation. Some dualists say this. They say, sure, the physical chain of events is complete, but they don't conclude that somehow the mind isn't really immaterial. What they conclude is that the mind doesn't have any causal powers of its own. The mind, rather, mental events are caused by physical events, but they don't do any physical jobs of their own. Epiphenomenalists say that mental states are epiphenomenal on physical states. This means that they're byproducts of physical states, but they don't actually do anything in the physical world. Sometimes people have a metaphor of an old steam train with the steam rising out of the front. The mental states then would be the steam. The physical states are doing all the work in the physical world, but as byproducts they produce, according to the epiphenomenalist, certain feelings, certain emotions, certain experiences in us. Now, that would allow for the mind to be immaterial and not to be doing any physical job in the world. But that's a really hard one to swallow. Maybe it's intolerable. Because we do want to say that that brave feeling that Albert had does some work for him. It leads him to pick up the phone. And yet the epiphenomenalist says the brave feeling is just a byproduct. It doesn't change your physical activities at all. Your happiness, your sadness, your feeling of desires, your feeling of strong belief, these are just byproducts of what's going on in your brain, but they don't cause actions, cause events in the world. And I think there's something quite dreadful about that belief. We feel that that this feeling of passion for doing something is going to lead us towards that activity. There's something that denigrates the feeling of passion if it's just a byproduct that does no physical work at all. So epiphenomenalism is an option, but very few people take it. I find all these arguments powerful, but they can't all be right. They can't all be, as philosophers say, sound. Well, a sound argument is an argument that is right in every possible way. The premises, the assumptions of the argument are true, and the conclusion follows from the premises. So they can't all be perfect. At least the argument for dualism or the argument for physicalism have to fail. Something's got to be wrong. And as I say, the stakes are high here. Anybody have any last thoughts on where an argument goes wrong? Yes, at the back.
What about electricity? Is that physical?
Yes.
So that isn't the brain largely made up of physical impulses, electrical impulses?
Well, I don't know enough about the brain to say it's largely made up of physical impulses, but suppose it is. Is that what are you going to do with that point? Okay.
So that then supports the argument that the brain is physical.
I think nobody's going to deny that the brain is physical. The brain is part of the body, it's a physical entity. What they're wondering about is whether we should identify the mind with the brain, or whether we should say it's some kind of non-physical thing that is somehow connected to the brain and the rest of the body. But that's a very helpful point to clarify matters. Yes?
Even if the mind is a byproduct of the brain, let's assume that.
Yes.
Then if you kill the brain,
yes.
Where does the mind go? Can you detect it?
I feel like looking.
Yeah. If there is a place in the celestial universe, then we haven't detected that either. So it comes down to belief, really, doesn't it? It's not argument or logic, it's belief.
Well, the first point is I wouldn't be too hasty to say, well, a particular position comes down to belief. This is not in the domain of arguments. And the reason I wouldn't be too hasty is if we hadn't ever heard the arguments for and against dualism and physicalism before, we might think, look, how on earth could we rationally decide between them? Clearly, arguments aren't going to help us. But I think these are quite useful arguments worth exploring. So there are arguments to be found even when it's not obviously their domain. So there may well be arguments, if you're a dualist, about whether an immaterial mind or soul can go on after the body's death or not. But there's a prior question, which is whether dualism is tenable, whether you can hold it at all. Because if dualism is not tenable, if you finish these arguments for physicalism and we just say, well, dualism's had it, then it's really a moot point whether the immaterial mind can go on or not after the body's death, because we just shouldn't believe in an immaterial mind at all. Yeah. Yes.
This matter of the pathology of the brain,
okay,
and the fact that the body and mind continually interact, and the mind is affected by, senility or Parkinson's or a condition of that nature. What are we to say of the immaterial mind in those circumstances? When is there a transition that we can philosophically deal with? Because at the end of the day, the mind is diseased.
I think that the pathology example is a really helpful one to illustrate the tremendous intimacy between brain states and mental states. It's perfectly clear, it's really hard to deny, for example, that certain kinds of decay and pathologies in the brain are going to profoundly affect the mind. And I think what it does is it places pressure on the dualist to try and explain this connection. And it makes the life of the physicalist easier. You can just say, of course the mind is diseased. That's because the mind is the brain, and the brain is clearly diseased. So it seems to me that the import of that point is to place more pressure on the dualist and make life easier for the materialist. Yeah. Yes?
On the subject of the diseased brain, take schizophrenia, for example. That is treated, the brain is treated with chemistry.
Yes.
Which dulls the mind that is playing games. Am I right?
Well, another example to place pressure on the dualist, it seems to me. I think remark more than question was something to pile on difficulty for the dualist, is that we offer certain medical interventions which influence the brain in certain kinds of pathology, and those interventions in turn influence the mind. Yeah.
But how do we know they're influencing the mind? It's just they're influencing the brain physically.
No, the person with schizophrenia no longer has those mind games going on.
It's the physical mechanism of the brain that is at fault, this disease.
Well, I mean, it seems the medicine wouldn't be doing its job if you were to go to the doctor and say, look, you know, I'm still feeling terrible, and the doctor were to say, no, well, that's okay, because your brain is looking delightful. You know, it's really, there's some real improvements in your brain. It's okay if you're having the delusions. Your brain's magnificent. The medicine is designed to reduce the delusional or other pathological experiences you're having. So it's physical stuff, the medicine, which is supposed to affect your mind. And the dualist has to explain how that can possibly be if the mind's not physical at all. I want to turn now to our third question, which is a question of free choice. And tomorrow we turn to ethics. But there's a famous philosophical debate on whether we have free will. And the way I want to begin it is by asking what it is to choose freely. Suppose I'm walking along one day and I come to a forking path. I could choose left or right. I'm in no great hurry. I don't have a sense that either path is going to be better to take. It feels like I can freely choose which path to take. And so I choose one of the paths. Now, here is a question which we'll begin with, which is, what is it to make a free choice? Presumably, we make free choices all the time, right? We make tiny ones about which way to shift when we're feeling uncomfortable in the seat. We make larger ones about which course to choose, about, I don't know, which person to marry, all sorts of things. But it feels like many of our choices are free. Here's an example of a free choice. What is it here to have chosen freely? What does that mean?
No coercion.
No coercion? Okay, so nobody is standing, walking alongside me with an axe and saying, I suggest the path on the right. Okay. If I were to move along rightwards, nobody would say I'd chosen freely. So nobody is coercing me. Nobody's forcing me. That is a good. That's a good feature. Anything else? Yes. Yes, you.
You're made up of your experiences, where you've come from, what you've heard, what you've done in your life, and those will always influence the decisions you make. This doesn't excuse them, because if you're a bad person, you're a murderer, you can't just say, well, this is how it was brought up. But although you do have free choice, there's an enormous amount of stuff that is not free because of where you've come from and what you've learned.
Okay, now the thought is, and this is a helpful thought because we'll be coming to something which exploits it later, that your experiences might hinder your freedom by inclining you automatically one way or the other, but nonetheless there is space for a free choice despite the weight of experience. Is that the idea? Okay, so we have an idea of what free choice involves. It's not being coerced. We have an idea of something which might hinder free choice, but which we can circumvent, the weight of our experience. Any other thoughts on what it is to choose freely? Yes.
The choices need to be equally as attractive.
To choose freely?
Yeah, so that both sides of the path look nice. If the one looks like we're going down a precipice and you die,
yeah,
that's not really a fair choice?
Well, look, there are two thoughts here. The first way you express the thought is to say, in order for me to choose freely, the choices need to be equally attractive. Now, look, I think I chose my spouse freely. I mean, I've been married for some years, and I like to think it was a free choice of spouse. It wasn't coerced. But it's not the case that my choices were equally attractive. All right, look, nobody was lining up, you know, in a row for me, but suppose they had. My choice of Lisa as spouse wouldn't have been any less free because I found her more appealing. So I think that isn't quite the right formulation. But I like your idea that if there's a precipice, if I notice a precipice on one side, then I'm not really choosing freely to turn rightwards because there aren't really two choices. There's only one choice, assuming I want to preserve myself. Fair enough. Perhaps this could be linked to the coercion point. It's almost as though I'm being coerced rightwards. If there's a roadblock or a precipice, I just can't go left. Yes. Well, let me give you, and the truth is, I'm being tricksy here because it's going to lead us into problems, but these will be fruitful problems. Let me give you an initial analysis. Some people offer a free choice, and they say this. What is it to have chosen freely? I choose the right-hand path, let's say. What is it to have chosen that right-hand path freely? Well, to have chosen freely is this. I've chosen freely if I could have chosen differently. In other words, if more than one choice was genuinely open to me. If I've taken that right path, and it's the case that I could have alternatively taken the left, people say, well, that is what it is to have chosen it freely. If there's more than one option open to you, and you choose one of them, you've chosen freely. That's how it goes. And it's this analysis which I think seems quite natural at first, the linking of free choice to a number of options, which leads us to a famous philosophical worry. And it's a worry about our capacity for making free choices at all. Many of you will have heard of determinism, which is the philosophical position that every event that takes place is fully determined by events that preceded it. To put it in a glamorous kind of way, if somehow you could know the facts, all the facts about the universe at any given time, and you had these fantastically advanced calculating powers, you would be able to say what would happen at the next moment. Well, it's unclear whether determinism is true. A number of people think that determinism is right, and they base their views on the physical universe. They say, well, according to some views of physics, everything that is happening now is enough to determine what is about to happen. And they say, well, human beings are part of the natural world, so we're part of this deterministic universe. Of course, we're far from knowing what's going to happen. That's because our knowledge is severely limited. But nonetheless, if we could know all these things, we would know what was going to happen next. It's unclear whether determinism is true. The jury is still out, but it might be true. And if it is true, it seems like a worry for free will. The worry goes something like this. If determinism is true for human choices, if all our choices that we make are determined, then it seems like we never truly have more than the option we chose. Remember that previous analysis of freedom. The idea was our choice is free if we could have chosen other options. But determinism seems to imply that we didn't have any other options. We may have thought so. We felt free. We arrived at this path and thought, should I go left or should I go right? And yet when we went right, everything about us and about our environment had determined that. Our temperament, our beliefs, our desires, our social environment, our physical environment, all work together to determine our rightward path. So if determinism is true, the thought goes, then we don't have free will. Determinism may well be true, in which case we may well not be able to make any free choices at all. It's, I think, a very disillusioning thought. Let's spend a moment wondering whether, in fact, it is such a terrifying thought. I mean, suppose I said, all right, big deal. Maybe I don't have free choice. Why be concerned about that? I can still think about the world and my fellow human beings in just the same way. And is that true? Can I do that? What disappears? If I don't have free will, what disappears that I think should be there?
Guilt.
Sorry?
Guilt.
Guilt. Oh, what a, what a blessing. something to hope for then. Your dinner doesn't disappear, but the guilt is gone. It's fantastic. Guilt is a good point, and more generally, some people think that if we didn't have free will, then praising or blaming somebody for what they did would no longer make any sense. They think that blaming somebody, for instance, for doing something is predicated on their having had other options. Right? Why do I get peeved when my little boy sits on the bed in his shoes? Because I feel that he had other options. He could have taken off his shoes before he sat on the bed. If it were the case that none of us had any free choice, that everything were determined, it would seem very unfair to blame him for sitting on the bed in his shoes, right? His beliefs, his desires, his temperament, his physical and social environment would all have determined that moment. And so it's not his fault. He had no other option. That's how the idea goes. Of course, you could still say it's a bad thing, it makes the bed dirty. That's true. But it seems like you wouldn't be able to say it's his fault. It feels like none of us would be at fault for anything, and presumably none of us would be worthy to be praised either. If you were that lucky sort of person, born under the right star, so to speak, who had a most marvelous life from beginning to end, were blessed with friends and love and honors and of all kinds, well, it somehow wouldn't be due to you because it wouldn't be due to any of your free choices. All of that would be determined. So this is the concern, this is the worry people have about free choice. And it's a worry that a number of philosophers have tried to do something about. Does anybody want to respond to this concern? Think about responses that could be offered.
Yeah.
I'll get you in a moment.
I've just read a lovely quote which fits in beautifully here in a book that I bought here at summer school. Determinism is the hand of cards you've dealt. Free will is what you do with it.
I think that is nice. It reminds us, well, it reminds me of the ancient Stoics. It's a Stoic called Epictetus who was born a slave. And Epictetus became a famous philosopher. He was a great inspiration to a number of military people in the ancient world who became Stoics. And one of the things he and his fellow Stoics used to say are that the facts lie outside your gates, by which they meant that there are certain circumstances that you simply receive. There's nothing you can do about them. But how you react to them and how you act are entirely up to you. Certain matters lie outside your gates, but what the Stoics were concerned with was not bemoaning whatever fate had given you, but acting rightly in response to it. Now, it seems to me that that's quite an inspiring kind of philosophy. But it also seems to me that this worry about the impact of determinism on free will undermines that approach. Because what that approach seeks to distinguish is those matters which are simply determined and those matters over which you can exert your free choice. This approach undermines that because it seems to say there are no matters potentially over which you can exert your free choice. So that your thoughts and your actions would be just as subject to being determined as anything that was outside you. That's the concern, that's the threat. There was somebody who wanted to... Yes. Did you want to speak?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I think determinism would destroy all ethics, and there'd be no basis if there was determinism for standing outside Auschwitz and saying this was terribly evil and terribly wrong. And it would destroy really the basis of human existence, that we know it and we strive for it.
I feel bad now for saying how nice it would be if there were no guilt, because it's a dramatic point.
And the second point that I'd like to make, isn't determinism itself an illusion which is incapable of any form of proof?
Right,
because it depends on an inductive argument, and we know what problems Hume had with induction which the physical scientists haven't addressed yet.
Okay, good. Let's deal with each of those points. What do you do when standing outside Auschwitz if every human act, every thought and belief and desire is fully determined? Well, the worry is that you may fairly only be able to say, this was a dreadful thing. This was a thing of cataclysmic damage that caused great misery, and yet you wouldn't be able to blame anyone for it because, in a sense, it wouldn't be their fault. They had no other option but to do what they did. It's a frightening thought. Now, we're going to see a way to think of free choice in a different manner, and we'll see if we can approach this entirely differently and circumvent the fear. But as for the second point, well, what could show whether determinism was right? What philosophers and philosophers of science often think nowadays is that this isn't a matter for philosophy, the question of whether the world is deterministic, it's a macro level, a large level, not just a kind of tiny quantum level, is a question for physicists to work out, and it's a question whose answer won't become clear until finally, if we have one, we have some final theory of physics which explains how the physical world works. As I say, at the moment the jury's out. Determinism may well be true, it might be false, but the fact that we're unsure doesn't take away the worry. Because if you think that the truth of determinism means that we have no free will, then you have to live with the possibility that we have no free will, because determinism might be true. Is there something we can do about this? Well, right, so is there something we can do about this fear that my move to the right, if it's fully determined, shows that I have no free will, I couldn't have freely done it? Well, here is a response. We had an analysis of free choice which got us into this problem. The analysis was that to choose freely is to choose in such a way that you had other options which you didn't take. You could have taken them, but you didn't. And that made determinism a real threat. Maybe that's not the right analysis of free choice. Maybe if we analyze it differently, determinism will no longer threaten us. And this is what some philosophers have done. These philosophers are called compatibilists. They're called this because they think that determinism and free choice are compatible. That even if determinism is true, it's still frequently perfectly appropriate to say that a person is chosen freely. Now that may seem weird to you. You may think, how on earth, if I couldn't have chosen otherwise, can it be fair to say that I've chosen freely? Well, this is a wonderful opportunity to perform a certain philosophical method. We had an analysis which has led us into trouble, the analysis of free will, free choice. So now we stand back and say, how else can we analyze free choice? Well, one useful thing to do, to begin, is to think of some intuitive cases, some cases where intuitively we do or don't act freely. So here's the obvious case, the person with the gun to their head. When he picks up the phone, right, if the person with the gun has said, phone X, when he phones X, he hasn't acted freely. Does anybody want to offer, just to increase our stock of intuitive cases, more kinds of cases where intuitively a person has not been free in their choice?
Between a rock and a hard place.
Do you mean that as a metaphor or as an exciting adventure story? Between a rock and a hard place. So,
where both choices are unpalatable.
Yeah. Yes, but where both choices are unpalatable.
So you don't choose freely.
Yes, that sounds dreadful, because it's unclear what you do. Look, if you're stuck in, if I happen to be walking on Signal Hill and a giant boulder happens to be rolling towards me, and I'm running down the hill and the boulder's sort of nipping at my heels, so to speak, and I see a thorn bush on the right, and I jump into the thorn bush, I presumably haven't freely chosen to jump into the thorn bush. There was no real other option for me. Okay, so there's an example. Anything else apart from guns and rocks?
Hobson's choice.
Is that the same as two unpalatable options?
No, as far as I know, meat is only one choice. So you can have water.
Oh, yeah.
Water, you know.
Oh, okay. Okay. Look, I clearly haven't chosen freely when, intuitively, when there's only one thing for me to do. Yes, agreed.
Maybe were there issues of duty?
Who said that? Yes, were there issues of duty?
That conflict with your morals.
Yes. There may be cases where duty is so strong that I simply feel bound to do a particular thing. And there are all kinds of other cases we can think of. Perhaps I am brainwashed into holding a certain belief, performing certain actions. It feels like I'm not acting freely. It feels like we've got a great stock of those. But our intuition, I think, is not that everything we do is not free. Although we can think of a great stock, we can think of an equally large, even larger stock of cases where I do act free, right? I decide whether to move left or to right, or left or right. I decide which course to take at the summer school. There are all kinds of cases where I act freely. So here is the first step. We've thought of some examples where we do act freely and where we don't. Now let's try and think of an analysis of free choice which makes sense of those cases. Here's the homework. That analysis of free choice we had earlier led us into real problems. We all felt this existential despair. We felt full of dread. We thought, if determinism is true, then we don't really have free choice. Give us another analysis that seems to take care of these intuitive cases, that seems to explain them, and which isn't threatened by determinism. Offer an analysis of free will which allows us to act freely sometimes, even if determinism is true. We'll pick up on that tomorrow. We'll see if we can do that. It's time for, I think, two questions to finish. Anybody have thoughts? Yes. Yes, I do think that. Yes, I think that is perfectly intuitive. I think we do want to say that we very frequently act freely, even though we may be influenced by the past. And I think what we need is an analysis of freedom which respects that kind of intuitive judgment, rather than which allows for the possibility that every single thing we do may not be free at all. So that's the challenge. Last question at the back, yeah. I'm sorry, would you mind speaking a bit louder?
What are your thoughts on experiments in neuroscience which are more and more indicating that determinism to be true and agency not to be true?
Which ones are you thinking of? Libet?
There are two. There's a recent one where they have 60% odds of figuring out what you're going to choose before they even ask the simple binary question.
Yes. Look, I think neuroscience offers, it was not in the scope of this course to discuss it, but it turns out that there are scientific experiments which shake our sense of frequently acting freely. For instance, there's a famous series of experiments which seem to show that our conscious perception of an event is not actually causing us to act on that event, because we act on the event before we consciously perceive it. So I think this is not the forum to discuss neuroscientific results, but neuroscientific results are challenging. They shake the sense that we act freely in as many cases as we think. And I think here is a lovely example of an area where philosophers have learned a lot from empirical scientists. Thanks all very much. I hope to get some lovely analyses tomorrow. We'll see you there.